Welcome to the Lone Boss Podcast, your place to hear down-to-earth conversations with passionate leaders in the tech industry. Here's your host, JP Conklin.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of the Lone Boss Podcast. I'm your host, JP Conklin, joined as always by the real boss of Lone Boss, Sarah, my lovely wife.
Good morning.
Good morning. So today we have a very exciting guest. I met John Espy probably about 2 months ago, and I was introduced to him by a mutual friend. And so I went over to his office and actually recorded a podcast there. He was thoroughly professional. He had a black belt in recording podcasts, and I immediately realized I am in trouble and I need to get way better at this. So he has graciously agreed to sit in and allow me to cut my teeth again with him on the other side, basically carrying me through another podcast.
He has joined us for amateur hour.
I think it's more of an ego boost than anything. Good morning, John, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much, JP, and thank you for the kind words.
So let's start with just a little bit of background about you first. Mm-hmm. Did you grow up in Charlotte?
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area until I was about 28 years old. And then I moved down here for a consulting company that I was working for at the time that was expanding.
Now, before we talk about that, are you a Washington football team fan?
That's debatable. I'm a Redskins fan, and I think that my love for that team has been dying for the last 10 years. So this might be a good time to switch. But yes, I am a long-suffering Washington football team fan.
So I am an Eagles fan, and we play on Sunday. And I have no idea what this is going to be like without fans in the stand.
It'll be interesting to see that's for sure. And I wonder how long they're going to be able to keep it up. Some of the other leagues, I think it's a little bit easier to avoid contact between the players. But I can't imagine that one player gets COVID and that it doesn't spread instantly to everybody.
Like imagine the offensive and the defensive line clashing over and over and over again the entire game. One of them has COVID. Like somebody has to catch that, you would think, right? And then how do they handle that? Do they shut everything down? Do they postpone games?
Well, that's just it. You've got to postpone for 2 weeks in theory. And right. There's one game a week and there's 16. Are they playing a 16 game season? I guess.
I don't even know. I literally didn't realize football started this week until yesterday.
Wow.
I had totally forgotten.
Somebody had mentioned that it starts on Thursday, and it was kind of surreal to me, and I haven't really processed it. But yes, we could be watching this Sunday.
And I'll probably watch Thursday night. I think I'm most interested in seeing how the NFL handles an enormous stadium without any people. It's different for an NBA. Like, they brought it down, and they put up the backdrops with the interactive fans and stuff, but I don't know that translates.
Well, they can learn from the Jaguars. My family all live in Jacksonville, and they've been dealing with this challenge for 4 or 5 years now.
Zoom in very close. Yes.
tight shots.
Now, what were you like as a kid?
You know, I was, I don't know how I would describe what I was like as a kid. I played a lot of sports. I did well in school. I think I was pretty bored with school, frankly. And so I didn't excel the way that my brother did. I had a brother who was number one in our high school, then graduated number one at UVA. I did just enough to get by, but I think I understood the concepts pretty well. I was a pretty curious person. I liked to look at the way things work. More than anything, I just always had a hustle in me. The minute I saw snow, I grabbed a shovel and went and shoveled the neighbor's driveways. I was always mowing lawns and then turning around and buying candy and selling it on the bus. And so I just always had that spark to go hustle, but I did well enough in school, but not certainly not as well as I probably should have. I didn't really get my act together academically until 2 years into my 6-year undergrad program.
And so I think you ultimately ended up going to Duke for an MBA.
That's correct.
Presumably because you could not get into Keenan Flagler, I would assume.
That's the only reason anybody goes to Duke. Well.
Did you have a least favorite subject when you were in school?
I think growing up, I really gravitated towards science and math. I probably didn't like history or some of the English classes, which is ironic because now I love to read literature and I love to read history. But I found them both pretty boring when I was younger. But science to me was something that always, it just seemed cool to me that we could figure out how the universe works and repeat that. And in fact, a 13-year-old kid can do physics equations. I think I always appreciated the thing things that we were able to do in the science classes.
Yeah. Now, I read on your blog that one of your favorite books of all time is Thinking Fast and Slow.
I do love it.
Which is probably my favorite book of all time. It was just groundbreaking to me, right? It just gave me a total appreciation of thinking about life and business in a totally different fashion and just how many biases we have from all of our experiences and expectations. And it slants everything we do. We just constantly have to check ourselves.
I think you're exactly right. We have to check ourselves. And it's something that I try to remind myself of. What heuristic am I using that might be pointing me in the wrong direction? And when do I need to slow down? I'm a very impatient person. And usually when I'm on the fast brain, I just leave it and drive, if you will. I mean, it's funny. I have a mentor who told me, related to that, we weren't talking about the book specifically, but it's related to it. He talked about, we've all been on autopilot where you just all of a sudden come to while you're driving and realize you were on autopilot. Right. He's like, you don't have to have a Tesla. We've all been in a self-driving car.
So true. So true. I think even one point a couple of weeks ago, I came home and I told her, I was like, I actually don't remember large chunks of that drive. I could not describe to you, which is a little scary to me. I was like, but did I make any progress with those thoughts? Or was I just wondering who are the Eagles going to cut and how are we going to make up for that ridiculous second round draft pick that we made this year with Jalen Hurts? Apologies to the Hurts family. Now, last question when you were a kid was, what did you want to be when you grew up?
It's funny. I wanted to, like most kids, I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps. He was an accountant and I asked him, why are you an accountant? And he said, I wanted to get into business. And back then that was the easiest way to get into a business was to start out in accounting and you learn a lot about the business. But he at some point told me, even as I was pursuing an accounting degree in undergrad, he said, I think things have changed. I think that information technology is what accounting was when I was coming up. And I, you know, if you can get involved in that, you need to. And I saw it. I went and did the interviews on campus and I saw what people were getting paid that were accounting majors. And so I added a second major in information technology. I can't say I never used the accounting degree. It actually came in incredibly useful. If you can read a balance sheet and a P&L, if you're developing software, it might not be as important, but a lot of the things I've done, I'd say the second half of my career to date, have been very focused on being able to evaluate a company or a project, and having those skills is very useful. But I never went into accounting as a profession, even though I thought for all of high school and half of undergrad that was what I was going to do for a living.
So it's really then in college that you started to develop some sort of interest in technology.
Yeah. So I mentioned my brother. He knew from day one he wanted to be a software developer. The minute he wrote a line of code, he just loved it. And it was the minute I first did a computer science class, I hated it and wanted to run away from it. But I was okay at it. I was good enough at it. But as I saw the things he was working on during his summer internships and how much fun he was having and the passion that he applied to it, it was really inspirational for me. And so even before I added that second degree, I started teaching myself how to program some of the languages. And it was nice because I could go to him and say, here's what I'm trying to build. And he could show me a better way to do it. I ended up taking my first job out of college as a software developer for a consulting company, having only taken one computer science class in my entire undergrad. But I knew how to program because I had done side projects and had talked to my employer at the time while I was an undergrad into letting me develop some software for them. And so I had real world practice doing it, but only ever took one formal class in it.
And that's what brought you to Charlotte?
Eventually. Yeah. That job that I had, that was during school. Then I went to work for a consulting company that was in a death spiral, but I didn't know at the time. I started working there during the dot-com craze, and then the dot-com crash crashed on top of them. I survived 6 rounds of layoffs with that company. But after you see enough layoffs, it's just so demoralizing. And so even though I was working on meaningful projects and making really good money, I saw a chance to join an 8-person startup, and they needed some of the skills that I had developed with this consulting company. And so I went to work for them. And ultimately, I ran 2 projects for them in the DC area. And then they sold a deal down at Family Dollar here in Matthews at the time. And the project manager that they had sent to run the project had some personal health issues to deal with in the family, couldn't travel from Virginia. So I started traveling from Virginia down here, and I just fell in love with this town. There's really a lot to like about this town, especially by that point, I was living pretty far outside of DC, way out in the suburbs. And the prospect of having more choices than Olive Garden and Carrabba's and being able to afford living in the city, it was just awesome. And so after a year of traveling back and forth DC to Charlotte, I ended up moving down here.
All right. So you mentioned Olive Garden, presumably not your favorite restaurant in Charlotte. Do you have a favorite restaurant in Charlotte? Like, do you have a go-to spot?
It's funny. I really like Noble Smoke right now. If I'm looking at like a lunch or a more casual dinner, I just think they've got the best barbecue in town. Their brisket's really out of control good. I really used to like X on Provence for more of a date night type of thing, but they shut down pre-COVID even. I'd probably say Fig Tree is one of my favorites. Oku is really good.
Good spots.
Yeah.
All right. So you come down to Charlotte. Mm-hmm. You fall in love with the city. Sarah, I don't think you've probably read his resume. It's essentially just successful startup after successful startup after successful startup.
Oh, there's some bombs in there too.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to say he appears to have the Midas touch. And before we talk about all the ones that appeared to be the Midas touch, did you have any that were maybe the opposite of that?
Sure, absolutely. And I think everybody does. It's cliche, but it's true. You don't learn from success. You learn from failing. And so I think luckily for me, the failures weren't so big and so expensive that they ruined me. But I developed my first product that I tried to commercialize over a series of years. It really started out as me building an app to track my shoes so that I would know how many miles I'd put on them while I was training for a marathon and know when to buy new shoes. And then it turned into just it was something I used for myself. And then I started getting into P90X workouts and all sorts of running programs. And so I ended up building this really complicated project. Never got it on the App Store, never got it in front of any users, never even turned it into a company. But it was a failure in the sense that I learned you can tinker on a product forever, but if you don't get it in front of customers and know how they're using it, that's all you're going to have is a hobby. Right. And so I would count that as a failure, even though I put no money into it. I did put a lot of time, but I don't count it as a failure because I learned every time I wrote a new module of code, I would go out and look at new libraries to do it with. And I would say, oh, here's an interesting technology. Because by that point in my career, my day job, I was working, I was running the business that I talked about that I moved down here for. I was the COO of that company and we had grown it to 135 people by that point. And so it was a way, I wasn't exactly working on technology hands-on. And so it was a good way for me to stay hands-on with the technology. So that was one. Then I had a friend call me up. He had an idea of an app where you could kind of set goals for yourself or for others, and then you could invite your friends to participate.
Hold on. You could set goals for others? Yeah. Don't tell her about that. I'll have a list of goals by the end of the day.
So we had things like you could challenge somebody to lose weight, to quit smoking, to finish a class, to get a certain grade in a class. And we had a well-defined list. It was a really well-thought-out product actually that my friend came up with. And I was able to repurpose some of the fitness tracking app that I had built and pretty quickly build a product. And then I went and built a mobile product on top of it. And he and I funded it. I built a lot of the code and then managed projects for the parts that were beyond my expertise. And we got users on it. We actually started making money because the idea was that you could tell somebody, I'll give you $50 if you finish this goal. And then at any point you could ask them for progress. So if it's losing weight, they could take a picture of the scale. There were all sorts of verification things that we built, and you would just have a feed on the app that looked like Twitter, you know, would show all the different progress steps and how close you're getting to your goal, and people would move money on the platform. But I think that one we failed because I needed to be doing sales and marketing for that. And all we had contemplated was me building the product, and he thought he was going to have more time to go sell it. And so I then came up with an idea for a product, an app. So now I knew how to build apps and I kind of understood how that worked, and I knew how to get a product launched and approved on the App Store. And I came up with an idea for, let's optimize which credit cards you use. So if you're at a Best Buy, for instance, you might want to use the Best Buy credit card because it gives you 5% back. Or if you're buying a TV, there might be another card that gives you a free warranty. Or if you're at the Hertz desk, the Amex will give you better rewards than another one. And what we really wanted to do was optimize your wallet so that we could tell you which card to use for any given purchase, but we could tell you which cards to hold, and we could monetize by signing up for these affiliate networks. And that one was wildly successful from the perspective of it got featured number one on the App Store.
Oh, wow.
By the third iteration of the app, it was a great app. I had friends telling me, this is amazing. How did you build an app that I actually want to use and want my wife to use?
Right.
But where we failed was we didn't anticipate, I think, two things: how difficult the affiliate networks were. We were selling a mobile, very focused product into a market where to get paid the affiliate revenue for referring credit cards, they used metrics. We were, not to be crass, but we were selling, these guys were used to selling banner ads with penis pills on, you know, on them. And they didn't, they really, these networks really had no concept of these users want credit cards. Right. That's all they want. That's why they're downloading the app. And so whenever we would show them our metrics, they really couldn't wrap their head around it. They're like, well, you need at least 10,000 visitors a day to your website. And we said, but it's not a web app. It's a mobile app.
Yeah. And they weren't getting it.
They just didn't get it. And we finally convinced Cap One to get us onto their affiliate program. And they wrote a nice letter to Commission Junction. But it took 6 months with Cap One convincing them. And then Commission Junction wanted us to convince them of the same exact thing that Cap One did. And we just didn't have the energy by that point. And so we tried to pivot it into more of a personal financial management tool. And ultimately, we just couldn't find the right revenue model. I think the other thing that we learned was that if you have, so the affiliate networks were one problem. The other problem is the banks really are what you're selling. You're selling bank products on this platform. That's fundamentally what you're selling. But the savvy banks realized, I don't want your customers to take it, getting my credit card, because they're going to maximize the rewards, but they're not going to use it for anything else. And they want top of wallet behavior, which is where you just have one card that you owe.
You were essentially setting up an auction.
Yeah.
For credit card usage.
We thought, honestly, in the long run, that the way credit cards, and maybe they still will be, in the world of mobile wallets, there's banks should be able to bid on a given transaction and say, right. I want this business, so I'm going to give you a better reward.
And good luck convincing the banks.
Well, that's just it. It won't be a bank. It'll be Google or Apple.
Right, yeah.
Or some fintech. Yeah, it'll be somebody that figures that out. But we learned a lot about payments. We learned a lot about mobile wallets, user experience, and so the next thing that I did was I started a consulting company where we said, let's take all of the lessons we learned in building this app and let's bring that level of application building to big companies, because there's an innovation gap between big companies and smaller companies. And the reason that there is this gap, our insight was that a lot of software vendors don't know how to sell to banks. If you're not a banker, it's really hard to understand how banks want to buy. And my business partner at the time was a longtime technology executive from Bank of America. And so we said, why not take these technologies and bring them to the banks and bring them to big retailers and other big shops that normally probably can't access this type of technology.
And how'd that go?
That went really well. We grew that to about 200 people in just under 5 years. It was about a $40 million a year run rate company. We did really well with that business. Ultimately, we wanted to go different directions, my partner and I. And so I stepped down from the day-to-day of that in 2018. But I'm still a shareholder, still talk to him and a third partner that we had brought in by then on a pretty regular basis. They're doing great as can be expected in a COVID world.
Sure.
There are some industries that Delta Airlines was a client. And obviously, if you're an airline, one of the first things you cut are the consultants, in a COVID era.
Okay. So we're up to 2018. What's the next step for you?
So at that point, I knew what I wanted to do. And I'd started thinking about this concept at Level. So with Level, the consultancy, we built a really good marketing capability and a really good sales capability to sell our own services. But we also realized consulting helps to sell products. And so we stood up a value-added reseller business that we use to sell other companies' products. And my insight was that consultants understand products better than product owners do. We're just working with the customers regularly. And I had been brought in to look at a venture builder out of the UK. They own a portfolio currently of about 17 digital businesses. It's all digital enabling businesses.
Now, can you describe venture builder? Because I am not familiar with that.
Sure. So they're also referred to as venture studios. I like the term venture builder better than studio, because it's more than studio implies we're going to do workshops and design thinking, but a builder really builds all the things that you need to build a company, not just to provide capital. So in their case, they'll write a check to fund an initial idea, or they'll acquire an interesting technology. And then they've got about 3,500 employees across their portfolio, and they'll bring in the resources. So if a team needs marketing. They've got marketing experts. They've got, but at the core of it, they've got a consulting company that kicks off very reliable profits, which they then can invest into these businesses. The consulting company also is a pool of talent for them. And so a lot of their best employees in these portfolio businesses come through the consultancy.
Got it.
And again, not every venture builder does it the exact same way, but that was the way they operated. So they've got this portfolio of 17 businesses. One was a very successful payment processing API that they'd had a lot of success in Europe. And as you probably are aware, payments are processed very differently in the United States than in Europe. It's just, we have way more banks and much smaller banks. Yep. There's five different payment rails now. There's all sorts of complexities between the states versus, moving money between the states is a lot more complicated than it might be moving money from Brussels to Paris, for instance. The European Union has regulated a lot of that. But they had hired Level to look at bringing that business over to the United States. And then they said, why don't we do a joint venture with Level? And that was one of the things my partners at Level were not interested in. We would have been great to do it because we had the great payment capabilities, but they really wanted to focus on, we've built this business. Now let's focus on what we're doing and do that really, really well. So for a while I pursued doing this joint venture and I wanted to build my own venture builder. And I had already been thinking about it with Level. I was like, well, we've got this great sales capability, this great marketing capability, and we can build anything. We can design anything. Why don't we build our own products? And that project ended up going nowhere, though. The joint venture with them, they just decided to hold off on going after the American market. But I'd already developed the brand and I'd already developed the concept and had already started talking to people about it. And then I did some advisory work, did some angel investing, and I figured at some point I'd find another opportunity. I didn't want to start the venture builder without a venture. and I didn't have any great ideas in my mind of things that I really wanted to put it all on the line with. But I got brought in to advise a company, that a family office that owned a technology business that they wanted to get out of. And it wasn't a big enough business to hire a traditional M&A banker, but they reached out and got me to give them some recommendations. And the company is in the network security and network management space, which is not my area of expertise. I know enough about it, but it's not really. I come from more of an application development background. So I brought in a friend who in 2017 had sold his data center business, and he and I had invested in a couple of things together. We'd looked at a couple of investments that we passed on, and he was doing a lot of advisory work like I was, just kind of independent, help out with special projects. And I had him take a look, and he made the same recommendations I did. And he said to the owner, he told him what he recommended. The owner said, you guys are spot on, but we don't have the team to do that. I think we're just going to shut this thing down and see if one of our customers wants to buy it. And Tarek didn't even bat an eyelid. He just said, well, we can help you with that, but, or maybe John or I could just buy it. And George said, well,
now, have you agreed to that before?
No, we had not. I was hoping he would say that. but I really wasn't thinking about Defiance, is what I call the venture builder that we've since launched. But I just looked at him and I was like, yeah, we would. And so George said, well, make us an offer and, we'll see. And so we got an offer hammered out. And Tarek said to me, why don't we build a company? Why don't we start a company that does just this? We can acquire companies, we can start companies. And then he's like, I look at so many investments where I don't think they've got the team to get it done, and they can't, and they're far enough along to where they can't bring in a marketing co-founder or a technical co-founder or whatever. He's like, but if we could take controlling interest in companies and have like a roster of people that we bring in. So I showed him the company in the UK that I'd been looking at, and I showed him what I was working on. And within a month, we'd funded it, got the deal done, and started building up the portfolio. We've now got three acquisitions that we've done. We've started a consultancy. We've started building the sales team. We've got three more acquisitions that we're working on that should get done by the end of Q4, hopefully sooner.
Do you sleep at all, or?
I mostly just let the team do the work. So I do get some sleep, but no, it's been very hectic. It's been a lot of work because we officially opened our doors on March 1st.
Open the doors for Defiance.
For Defiance, that's correct.
Even though the idea had really...
I'd been working on it for a while.
Yep. And you had set things into motion well in advance of that.
That's correct.
You officially launched March. And since then, Defiance has really been going about... It sounds like you're really looking for those maybe founders who need someone to bridge the gap with skill set and team to just sort of take this, what is probably a really good idea and a really driven founder, and say, we're going to help you achieve this goal.
Absolutely. We've got some acquisitions we've done or are looking at where it is just at the founder. They've run into a limitation and they realize they need a team around them. And it's really, for some people, it's really hard to build that team. Sure. A lot of founders, it's very hard because they're, what makes them a good founder doesn't necessarily make them a great team builder always.
the founder's dilemma, right? Yes.
So there have been those cases. There's been the case of this family office. We just wiped out the entire senior management team. They'd been running it as a, for lack of a better term, they'd been running it as a lifestyle business. Yep. And I won't say milking it, but they didn't have the hunger that they needed. They'd been running this thing for 10 years. It had been shrinking the whole time. So we just, in that case, we didn't need the founding team. We brought in our own team and have been operating the business. There's another one that we're going to close here shortly where the founder just is ready to retire. And he'll be part-time engaged, and we're more than happy to do that. He wants to leave a legacy, and we think that we've got some connections in the banking industry that we can help accelerate his product and move it into. He's built a very fundamentally sound product in the security space. But it's focused on, I'd say, older banking applications like ATM machines and some older payment systems. We think that this product can be applied tokenization, mobile tokenization, e-commerce tokenization, and all sorts of transactions that are being done as our payment systems modernize in the United States.
Now, as you meet these founders, have you noticed any sort of common traits that has led to them maybe running into these challenges? Set aside the example of somebody who's retiring, just... There seems to be a common thread here that they run out of something, and that's when we were able to step in and bridge that gap for them.
Yeah, and more often than not, it's what they're lacking is on business development and marketing especially. And so we acquired a marketing agency that we run. We call it the Refinery House, and they come in and build all the top of funnel activities. And I think that's the number one challenge that I see founders in, at least in our city. I think if you go out to San Francisco or you go to Austin or you go to some of these more established startup hubs, I think that there's more talent in business development and in selling software and in marketing software. But that's the number, those are the number one and two challenges are marketing and sales. And we've also seen that sometimes a product was built the way that you built it 15 or 20 years ago and they haven't modernized it. And there's certain ways that buyers want to buy software. They typically want it to be OpEx and recurring and SaaS. And it's better for you as a business owner to do that. But 15, 20 years ago, that isn't how many of these companies did it. They also are a lot of the companies we've looked at, they started out in a world where there was a data center or an on-prem deployment. And people wanted to buy hardware, and that's what they're selling. In many cases, we see that. And I think you have to have a public cloud answer. Some of them have embraced virtual machines, which was a technology that was hot 15 years ago. Now you'd use more of what's called containers. And a lot of these founders, when we talk to them, they've been so focused on the product that they don't realize the way that you deploy software now has changed. And if you can't offer that deployment option to your clients, you're dead in the water in many cases.
So I assumed, probably incorrectly, that most of the people you were encountering were in the first few years of operations, but it sounds like you're dealing with some established companies.
In some cases, they're established companies. Yeah. There are some earlier stage ones for sure. Our mutual friend, we acquired a bond syndication platform that he's got a couple customers on it, but that's very early stage. But in many cases, it's more established companies for sure.
You touched on Charlotte as a startup community. Mm-hmm. Give me your thoughts on that.
So it's improved quite a bit. I would say that we've got a long way to go. I'm not one who thinks that we need to have venture capital here. I think venture capitalists will seek out good opportunities no matter where they are. After we get through this COVID mess, it's not that hard to travel. You've seen AvidXchange raise large sums of money from non-Charlotte-based investors. Map Anything did it. Passport has done it very well. Payzer has started doing it. So you can raise money without VCs being here. A lot of good friends of mine think that we need to have more VC money. And that's an excuse that startups use. It's an excuse to say it's hard to raise money in Charlotte. It's not if you have a good company and a good team. It's just not. There there are not enough good companies out there for Charlotte to be a limiting factor. I do think Charlotte has some real strengths as a startup community. Number one, I think that the business leaders are very welcoming, more so than in other southern cities. My experience has been that we started a smart grid company that I haven't talked about on this show, but there was a smart grid company that we started and we needed a contract manufacturer. We were working with one in DC. I was here in Charlotte and my co-founders were in the DC area. And I was able very quickly to get to the CEO of a large contract electronics manufacturer here in town. And it was amazing to me. He's, you know, I mean, his grandfather was textile owner and it was, you know, it's old money by any stretch of the imagination. So welcoming though. And every time I see him, he's like, "You're not leaving Charlotte, are you? You got to stay here." And I think there's a sense of community. And I don't know if that's because of people like McCall and Crutchfield or what it is. There's just a sense here that the business people pay it forward. And that's really important to a startup community because startups want to sell to big established business. When you can get in and network very quickly and get to the people that you need to get to in the city, I think that that's a huge strength that Charlotte has. I think the cost of living is great here. I think people want to live here. I think the amount of rent that you're going to pay when you need some space, even though it's double what I was paying 8 or 9 years ago, it's still half of what you'll pay in San Francisco or in New York. So there's some very real advantages. I think what we really lack is a base of multi-exit entrepreneurs, I think, or even single exit. We haven't had one exit that you can point to say that really changed the game. And when you look in Silicon Valley, there's a concept called the $1 trillion company. Have you ever heard about that? There's $1 trillion of market cap that can be traced back to one company, Fairchild Semiconductor. And from them, Intel came, Facebook. I mean, there's just a list of all of these massive companies and VCs, but it all started with one business that IPO'd and kicked off lots of talent. And you had a whole bunch of people running around who knew how to run businesses, how to build early stage teams, take risks, manage risks. And that's led to a very thriving ecosystem. All these incubators and accelerators and all these other things that surround it, those follow great entrepreneurs. It starts with the entrepreneurs and it usually starts with an exit. Another great example is in the DC area. I saw this firsthand. AOL minted, I think, 4 or 5 billionaires and probably 1,500 millionaires and all sorts of talent all over the place. Revolution Capital, if I'm not mistaken, came from Steve Case and they're now doing all sorts of investments. The VCs follow the success. And so to me, that's what we need, more John Stewarts at Map Anything. We need more Michael Pragers at Avid, but we need a big exit. And hopefully Avid is one of those, or Passport or Red Ventures. I'm encouraged by these aren't startups anymore,
right? Yeah.
but they did start here and they're in tech and they seem to all be heading towards some type of really good outcome that could really change the game for the local Charlotte scene.
And can you describe to us where you came up with the name Defiance?
So I was watching, there's an HBO 4-part miniseries about Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, who created Beats by Dre, and they call it the Defiant Ones. And I really was just inspired by their story. Here you had two very, very talented technical, I mean, they both came from sound engineering and producing records backgrounds, but they both were able to combine multiple skill sets. I mean, Jimmy Iovine was able to unwind some of the most difficult, contentious contracts in the recording industry, and he had connections, and he was just able to get just a roster of amazing talent, including Dr. Dre. And Dr. Dre, very similar story. And so I just liked the concept of defiance, defying conventional wisdom. So I started looking up, and I was like, well, I can get the name Defiance. So
that helped.
So I hired a visual designer that I knew, told her what I wanted to do. She went and watched the series. I showed her some brands that I really liked, and she did a lot of the work on the Level brand as well. And we worked on it for a good 6 months and came up with the brand that I was really, really happy with.
It's awesome. And the website's awesome. And the posts you make are awesome. And it's very clear that you have a lot of experience and you are committed to that process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Because it shows through.
So, been an entrepreneur since you were you started shoveling driveways at 6, 7?
Something like that.
So how do you keep track of all your ideas? Like, do you have a notebook by your bed?
I do. I mean, I have a note-taking app that if I get an idea, I'll write it down in there. I think, though, I get a lot of ideas and I'm fine forgetting 90% of them. It's the ideas that keep coming back and that keep me awake at night. Those are the ones where I'm like, I really need to do this. And that was the fitness tracking app. That was the reward summit, was what we called the credit card app. These were things that I just couldn't get away from the idea, and I knew I had to do them. But I think I get a lot of ideas and just forget most of them. And I get a lot of people who come to me like, will you sign an NDA? I want to bounce an idea off of you. And I'm like, I'm not signing an NDA to hear your idea. Are you willing to put everything on the line and put every dollar of your own money and mortgage your house and borrow money from your parents and all your friends for this idea? And if the answer is not 100% yes, then it's just an idea, right? Right. And I know you know this. You've put a lot on the line building this particular business when you already had another successful business. That type of commitment is what it really takes. It isn't, was Facebook really a better idea than MySpace? There's a lot of examples of it. It really wasn't about the idea. It was how committed is somebody to the idea? And are they committed enough to, when they get it wrong, they keep being stubborn and going after it and pivoting and making the changes that they need to make. I try to keep track of ideas, but usually big ideas like company ideas, it needs to pop up in my head two or three times before I really pay attention to it.
And do you find yourself like certain times, like driving, or is there certain times where things come to you? Is it just all the time?
That's a really good question. I don't know if there is any one time. I would say that it's usually when I least expect it. If I start thinking about something really deeply, I get too wound up about it. And it's usually when I stop thinking about it that I have an insight and I'm like, okay, now I need to think about it because now I've got this insight.
Now, when you have someone that comes to you with an idea, or you have someone that comes to you and says, I need help bridging the gap, what is it that you have found that they usually fail to think about? Like, what is it that people on this side of the table, when they come to you, you're like, here we go again. They did not consider this before they came to me.
I think the first thing is not everybody feels the same pain that they feel. So they may overestimate how important this problem that they're solving is. I think they don't think about the fact it's very, very, very hard to change behavior in people. I think everybody underestimates how difficult it is to change behavior. And if you can't create something that's 10 times better than the way they're doing it today, they're not going to change their behavior. And even if you make something 100 times better, they might not change their behavior. I learned this with Reward Summit. Everybody wants to save more money, get more money back on their credit cards, but it doesn't mean they're going to change to looking at their app every time. We had to switch to where we sense that you walked into a Target and we send you a push notification. And even that, that's changing behavior, because now you've got to answer this push notification. Right. The real answer in that scenario is we build it into the mobile wallet. And when you go to pay, the wallet is smart enough to say, use this card. Click here to apply for the Target card. But I tell people all the time, changing behavior is the hardest thing you're ever going to do. And people think I would do it. And I say, yeah, but I love going to the gym. But a lot of people find it really difficult, even though they know how good it is for them. It's just hard to change behavior. And the other thing, the biggest mistake that almost every entrepreneur makes when they build their first product is they underestimate the importance of the onboarding process. Everybody starts with, I know what I want the app to do. So I'm going to assume that every user knows, and I'm going to make it so that you have to go in and put in all this data and just fill out a big form. And then we're going to start using the app. And the problem is most users never will get through that onboarding process. You've got to think it through the way Groupon or LinkedIn or some of these other, the onboarding process is, to me, 80% of the success of most applications that I see. And most times people come to me either with an idea or they've built an app and they say, what do you think? And I'm like, I think that for a power user who already knows how to use the app, it's great. But what you're dealing with in the real world is, I may have downloaded this app because it popped up on the app store as an interesting app. I don't even know what it is. Right. And you're already asking me to give my credit card and my username and password and all these other things. And so I think that's something that most people who have an idea don't appreciate, how important that is once you make that leap and say, okay, I'm building the product now.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because while Loan Boss was still in beta, we had a really large firm reach out to us asking to look at the product, and they loved it. And one of the questions that they kept asking me over and over again, I made like 4 trips to their office, was about the onboarding and implementation process. And we had done it for a lot of clients in beta, but they were all people who knew us and knew no matter what, they'll eventually get it right. Even if it doesn't go the way I think it's going to go, I know these guys will take care of it, right?
And you're selling an enterprise product where they're going to be told you have to do this. So it's a little bit easier in that case, but it still is important.
Incredibly important. And so we eventually lost that business because they were just too large and too established to be able to take a gamble on a company that was still in beta. They just weren't comfortable with that. But what I learned from that was I had totally missed the signals that they were sending me. You have to assure us that you can onboard this. You have to assure us that you have the team to handle a company of our size. You have to assure us that we have a team of support personnel that we can call when there's a problem, right? I had just been in business for so long, and the people who were our beta testers knew us, that that was just kind of a given.
Yeah.
And here I was coming across somebody who didn't know me, and they're asking totally legitimate and reasonable questions, and I was basically ill-prepared to answer those. And so although we lost that business, it did force me to sit down and say, we need to commit to the onboarding and implementation process because this will not be the last time somebody asks those questions.
Absolutely. And that's really, I mean, one of the bane of the existence of any SaaS sales rep or product manager is churn, right? That's the number one thing that you live and die with. And if your onboarding process isn't, I don't think it can be completely turnkey. I know that a lot of SaaS vendors like to act like it's a turnkey thing, but you better have a customer support team. You better have dedicated reps who are helping or have a process, because otherwise the churn is just going to eat you alive.
Exactly. Yep. So let's shift gears a little bit to your podcast, which I love. And your focus is basically interviewing interesting entrepreneurs.
That's correct.
So before we jump into some of those people that you've interviewed, what was the catalyst for coming up with a podcast, and why was entrepreneurship your focus?
Well, so it started with, don't know why I was late to the podcast game, just using it as a form of consuming information. And I just love podcasts. I listen to health and fitness podcasts. I listen to news podcasts. I listen to political commentary podcasts, comedians. You know, I love listening. And I especially like long form podcasts. I just think it's a really good way to convey a lot of information. And I also just like learning new things. And so I have a friend who has a podcast. He owns a gym and a consulting business for gyms. And he's developed an online personality, and it's centered around a podcast and some video logging or vlogging that he does. And so I talked to him and I was like, hey, I think I wanted to start this. I really like talking to entrepreneurs. I've invested in companies. I've bought companies. I've sold companies. I've built them. Like, I think I'm well suited to talk to them. Of course, the first interview that I did, I realized I wasn't well suited to do it. And I had a lot to learn, both about the technical side of it, but also just how you conduct an interview. And I tell people, if you hate the sound of your own voice, try editing your own voice.
And that's why she does the editing for us.
It is one of the most humbling experiences of all time. But I can tell you that it's so rewarding. After I did my 10th episode, I went and did just a review of what I learned after the first 10. And it was amazing to me just looking back and looking at the quality of the product, both the production quality, but also just the way that I was able to frame questions, how I was able to work with guests who were a little nervous or anything like that. It's just, it was a lot of fun. The number one thing I get out of my podcast is when I have somebody I haven't talked to in a while and they're like, hey, I want to catch up. I'm like, hey, do you have an hour or two? Why don't you come drink some bourbon with me in the studio? We'll catch up, we'll record it, and then other people can hear it. And it's a great conversation. When else are you sitting across from somebody for an hour or two and just talking about a topic that you're both passionate about?
And so how do you find people who aren't necessarily just friends?
So I get a lot of referrals now. It's a funny story. A friend of mine, he's become a friend. I was doing some advisory work for Stratified. He was doing sales for them. He started listening to my podcast and he really liked it. He's like, this is great. I don't talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, so this is really cool. And he calls me one day and he was like, John, I just saw this kid on Fox News. He's doing surgical masks that he puts antimicrobial copper in, and he just produced 1 million masks in the last 2 weeks. Wow. And he's 29. And I was like, Paul, that's great. How the fuck am I going to get in front of this kid who was on Fox News? And he's like, I'm going to get him on LinkedIn. And sure enough, he sends me an email and I end up interviewing Jordan Schindler, who is New Fabrics is his company. And it's one of the coolest stories I've ever heard. But I literally met him the day before. He was working 110 hours a week. I mean, he went from, I don't know what his numbers were like before, but he was doing well, but he wasn't doing a million in 2 weeks, you know, and you could tell he was tired, but he was willing to jump on and do the interview. So it was cool. So there are quite a few of those where somebody says, hey, I want you to meet so-and-so. I was able, you know, Micah introduced me to you. And I really like the fact that you've started multiple businesses, you're running them and they're complementary, and the approach that you take to kind of firewalling the two is just very interesting to me. And so I get a lot of referrals, and sometimes it's as simple as I was doing a virtual yoga class when they first locked everything down. And I just reached out to the lady who was doing it because I noticed she had 160 people doing virtual yoga and they're paying $10 a pop. And I'm right. I was like, I'm just curious. Like, you're making more money now than you were with your studio? Right. And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, would you come on the podcast? And that's she was awesome. Like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, because I think I've also seen doctors. He interviewed Jack Asa, who did our outfit for our new office in here. It's just, it runs the gamut. And it's like, I'm really after that entrepreneurial spirit. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what the profession is.
That's really, for me, what's, you know, you find people that are interesting running mom and pop stores. And you find, I interviewed Igor Jablikov, the founder of now Prion, but his prior company, Yap, he sold to Amazon and it became Alexa. You know, and so, so I literally have interviewed single salon studio, or, you know, salon studio owners. I've interviewed people who own a single restaurant. And then I've interviewed, you know, the guy that invented Alexa. And to be honest, most of them are equally interesting because everybody's got a story and they've got a different journey that I think we can all learn from.
I also think with entrepreneurs, there is a level of respect because very few people from the outside looking in can appreciate the risk, the sleepless nights, the just leap of faith over and over and over again.
There's this weird romanticization, if that's a word, but we romanticize entrepreneurship and we think that it's this 23-year-old genius kid that gets out of college and just writes an app that changes the world. And that does exist, but there's a lot of dark times. There's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of scary times. And I think you're right. It's hard if you haven't lived that because the narrative is more of the positives of it. And even you saying, hey, I've seen your successes. Well, it's like a gambler. You don't hear about their losses much. But I actually worked with a lady named Terry Cox who used to run an organization called BIG, Business Innovation and Growth. And I had seen this lady, I can't remember her name now, Cass something or another, but she had created a conference that was celebrating failure and she called it FailCon.
That's awesome.
And I was just taken by it. And I called Terry and I was like, Terry, look at this. Like, I think I can get in front of this lady. Like, we got to bring this to Charlotte. And we did. Terry did a lot of the legwork because she had the organization that could do it. But we ended up bringing FailCon to Charlotte.
I missed it. Yeah. When COVID's done with, and you do that again, I want to be there. We probably have a couple booths we could set up. Now, is there anybody that you really wish you could have on your podcast? Like, if you look around, like, there are no limits. If I invite them, they say yes. Who would it be?
Actually, one of my very best friends in town, his name's Eric McCoy. And if you've ever eaten at Spoons, there's 3 food trucks and 3 stores that he's opened. He owns that. He used to own Stacks, but he sold the land to a developer. He started Heels.com. He sold it to Just Fab. He bought it back from Just Fab and then turned around and sold it to Aldo. Remarkable human being. One of the smartest guys that I know. He can really look at a problem and figure it out. When he built Heels.com, he was doing retargeting. He was inventing a lot of the concepts in modern advertising, and he just really, really understood how to advertise and find people online. And he's been involved in a handful of other successful business ventures. He just doesn't like to be in the public eye. And I tell him all the time, I'm like, Eric, people need to hear your story because it's fascinating. And he just won't do it. He just doesn't want to be in the limelight at all.
Yeah.
So now I've blown the lid on him.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how jealous will you be when he's in that chair a week from now and we're interviewing him?
I'd call that a 9.
Now, have you had a guest on that you have learned something from that you immediately and directly applied to either your life or your business? Did you like light bulb, thank you, and went and applied that?
Yeah, so it's not, this isn't the answer you're looking for, but the yoga studio owner, she told me about it. I thought I was into a lot of weird life hacking type of things. And she turned me on to essential oils and a couple things related to them. I immediately went and ordered them and incorporated into my daily routine. I think that there are definitely some other examples where somebody said something that I just hadn't thought about and it sparked an idea. Nothing's coming to mind, but I'm almost certain. We've recorded 51 now. And my guess is that there's probably at least four or five things that were just ideas I hadn't heard of before or a new way of thinking. And certainly there have been books that people have recommended to me that I've gone and downloaded and read and started talking about because they were just really good books.
So you've been exceedingly gracious with your time. We appreciate you coming by today. For anybody who's listening today who wants to come and check out Defiance or go and check out your podcast, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. So the podcast is available on all the major platforms. It's the Defiance Ventures podcast. And again, you can Apple, Spotify, any of the major platforms. They can go to defiance.ai is our website. I think that our Instagram account is at defiance.ai. They can follow us, find us on LinkedIn. We put every piece of content that we generate, we put out on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram pretty religious. As you've pointed out, as a lot of my friends point out, they're like, wow, you guys have a lot going on. And I would encourage any business to do the same. If you do something that you think is a big deal, put it on those social media channels. So I would encourage anybody who wants to learn more about what we're doing, I would just warn you that you're going to hear a lot from us.
And if you're a super interesting entrepreneur, reach out.
Absolutely.
Because he needs people to be on that podcast.
Absolutely. I'm always looking for, whether it's any of your listeners or any of their friends, I really enjoy meeting people. Some of my favorite interviews are the ones that are with people that I don't know at all.
Well, we've got one we're going to introduce you to after this podcast is over.
Awesome.
And see if we can get you guys linked up because she'll be a blast to have on.
Awesome.
Anything else before we go?
No, thank you. This was fantastic.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Thanks so much, JP.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to watching what Defiance does over the next couple of months because you guys seem to be crashing. It's pretty.
The hustle is real.
Yeah, the hustle is real. And maybe Micah didn't realize what he was getting into.
Yeah, there are days when I feel like, okay, I'm going to back off a little. We're running a little hard here. So.
How long does that last?
That lasts until the next day.
Exactly. Yeah. I play nice until I like wake up the next morning and then there's like 75 slacks that get sent out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Good morning. I forgot to say that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We look forward to the next one. And thanks again, John, stopping by and good luck the rest of this year.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
See you next time, everybody.
Thank you for spending time with us today. Subscribe to the Lone Boss Podcast for free on your podcast platform of choice and never miss an episode. Please give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show reach more ears. The Lone Boss Podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Pensford. To learn more about Pensford, subscribe to their weekly newsletter at pensford.com. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening.